Well, let's get started on this cold evening. Good evening and welcome to the fourth presentation in our seventh year of Faraway Places with Strange Sounding Names. My name is Brian Kuntz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague Peggy Wright, with assistance from our webmaster and photographer Haiwan Wong, our reference coordinator Brian Carson, and our technical specialist is the library's technology coordinator David Runner. Our speaker tonight is one of Western's most traveled scholars, having set foot on every continent and dipped his body in every ocean. Among his many travel goals were to go down the Amazon by boat, to visit Inca sites in Peru, to snorkel the world's Great Barrier Reefs off the coast of Australia and Belize, and to retrace the Viking voyages to North America, and explore Arabic bazaars, palaces, and forts. And unlike most of us who only dream of doing these exotic pursuits, our speaker tonight has actually done them. Since earning a PhD in physical geography from Indiana State University with a specialty in climatology in 1980, he's taught a variety of classes at WKU, served as director of the College Heights Weather Station, and conducted research projects leading to 70 articles and 90 public presentations. Every Thursday morning at 9:30, his program Up in the Air can be heard on WKYU FM, and during which time he discusses things about the atmosphere. He served as an expert witness for many court cases which have involved weather conditions ranging from traffic accidents to murders. He's a frequent consultant for business and government on projects as diverse as establishing safe areas to use as storm shelters or for monitoring floodwaters. He's an acknowledged expert on the Civil War and frequently takes part in Civil War reenactments. He once wrote, "For me, travel is not a love, it's an obsession." And in 1998, he received a sabbatical to explore his seventh and last continent. It's our pleasure to welcome for a return visit Dr. Michael Trapasso to talk about that least visited place, Antarctica. Michael?
Thanks a lot. That was a wonderful introduction. Antarctica is one of those places, again, trying to hit all seven continents. That was the last one to go to. And people react in one of two ways when you say you're going to go to the Antarctic. Half the people say, "Wow." And the other half of the people say, "Why?" And I'm like, "Yeah, ice? You're going to go look at ice?" You know, well, no, there's a whole lot more to the Antarctic than just ice. Let's, of course, as all good geographers should start with a map here. Let's kind of orient where we are. This is the Antarctic Peninsula, which is essentially the area we're going to visit tonight. And this is the southern tip of South America, okay, also known as the Horn. The blue is Argentina, believe it or not, that's a green, and that's Chile. At this point here, this red dot is Ushuaia. Ushuaia is a native term, a native name meaning the end of the world. And the Argentine people also call this El Fin del Mundo, the end of the earth. So it's kind of interesting to say that you've kind of stepped off the end of the earth. Of course, some people would like you to do that, but in a different way. Also, coming around this area, this water here is known as the Drake's Passage. Now, Drake's Passage is one of the most dangerous areas in the world to sail. In multiple references concerning any kind of nautical or movies dealing with pirates and sea explorers and sea adventure, so many of them make reference to going around the Horn as being extremely dangerous. In Ushuaia, there's a museum that has a map, and the map has countless little symbols, and the symbols are all the same. It's like a ship half underwater, meaning that it was sunk at that point in time. Crossing the Drake's Passage, you can say, "Well, gee, it's only this far on the globe." Yeah, yeah, it is, but by the same token, it's an extremely scary place to travel. Let's start with Ushuaia, because that was my base for a period of time. Ushuaia is roughly the size of Bowling Green, about 50,000 people. And from up here, it looks rather pretty, and it is, in some ways, kind of a quaint little town. Here's the basically kind of City Hall and Visitor Center kind of situation. It's kind of cute in some ways. But Ushuaia also has some problems. You know, unlike Bowling Green that has, you know, city and planning commissions and zoning and trying to keep some sense of some things, Ushuaia is just growing wherever they can find a place to build something. And things are kind of out of control in some ways, but still a neat little town, and kind of enjoyed that. This, well, unfortunately, with all these lights, some of these pictures are kind of washed out. This is the harbor area. Ushuaia is a fairly important port. You look out here, you could have anything. You might have Coast Guard ships, naval ships, cruise ships. Anything might come into and out of this particular harbor. So it's really, it was from here where we took off. And crossing the Drake's Passage. Now, this is a satellite image, an old one, but one that shows a number of different storms. Okay, let me get a little meteorological with you for a while. My students in the audience have heard the term subpolar lows. Another word is another term they use is circumpolar lows. These are very, very strong storms. Here's an example of one of them. And these are the ones that basically circle around through the Drake's Passage. And here's the peninsula, and South America is here, Drake's Passage, and makes this an incredibly harrowing ride. It's a 55-hour voyage from one to the other. So you figure, well, okay, 2 days, a little over 2 days can't be that bad. Well, we got out of protected water, and that first night, man, we got hit with a storm and just scared the ever-loving heck. Yeah, I know the mixed audience here. Out of me, I'll tell you that for sure. 36 hours of hugging your bunk, because otherwise you would be thrown around the cabin. I mean, there's laws of physics you might apply to airplanes you wouldn't necessarily apply to a ship. But scary nonetheless, and probably the most scared I've ever been, to be totally honest with you. All right, this is the ship. It's called the Explorer. The Explorer is not the love boat. This is not a big ship. From front to back, a little over 240 feet, maybe 45 to 50 feet long. Right? 90 passengers, three decks. I was lower port side, right on the water's edge. During the storm, they bolted an iron plate over the portholes because, well, like I said, we were getting thrown around pretty bad. And so this is the ship. This is the accommodation. You don't spend the night on the Antarctic continent. You cannot do that. You have to be on a ship. You can go and visit, but you have to leave. You can't even, you know, you say, well, I could set up a tent. No, you can't even do anything. If you're not staying at a research institute, you cannot stay on land. You have to go back. So everyone who would go has to stay aboard a ship. And again, here's the bow of the Explorer. It's not very big. Right, really, you put 20, 30 people out there, you put this crowd out there, and it'd be crowded. This is the bridge, and I was a frequent visitor. Part of my deal is I got this trip at an incredibly reduced price for two reasons. They were doing a public service, scientist in transport, and also I agreed to do some lectures and consult meteorologically for the captain on the bridge. And so I was a frequent visitor up there. He could fax in satellite images and maps and things that we could play with. Thank goodness they had lifeboats just before I left. Now this is, you know what this is. 9 years ago tonight, I was on that ship, literally 9 years ago tonight. On that ship, but just before I went on that ship, I did something that I thought was funny, turned out to be a bad idea. I went to see Titanic. Oh man, I thought it would be amusing. No, it was not. It is not funny. It was not. It was not funny. So seeing lifeboats was a relief. Right. Little weather station, of course. There's a weather station. I'm going to shoot it. After that herring ride, and they unblocked and they took the plate off of the porthole, that was my first look out the porthole. I'm thinking to myself, this better be worth it, because 36 hours of hugging your bunk was not fun. All right, got out on deck, very shaky. I had no sea legs at that point in time, so holding on for dear life. And this is, you know, the first glimpses, and I'm thinking, well, it better get better than this. And then as the clouds start to break and you start seeing it, it actually starts to look very nice. It's very beautiful in some ways. The Antarctic, in some ways, I would look at some of these pictures, and to me it almost feels like a different planet. Ice, there's a lot to be said for ice. It can be very pretty. Glacial ice, as you'll see very, very shortly, has tinges and shades of blue. It's actually a very pretty thing. Icebergs, as you know, most of it is underwater. Very little of it actually floats aloft. And, of course, we're passing through lots of icebergs as we're sailing everywhere. Icebergs, and then you can have iceberg fields, and this is a pretty picture. I've got a couple like this, and again, it gives you kind of that idea that you are someplace far from home. They get bigger. Here, icebergs also have a tendency to be sculpted by splashing water, wind, so ice has to endure some of the same things as landforms do, and they will start to carve and such. They can get real big. This is a whole lot bigger than the previous one. Again, some splashing around here, giving you that curvature. This is bigger than the one before. This thing I'd say you could put Western's campus on there. Yeah, that would be my guess. This is even bigger than that. I don't know how much of Bowling Green you could fit on top of this sucker. This is a big, gigantic one. And they get even bigger than that. This is the biggest one that we didn't go all the way around, but around part of it anyway. I want you to know that you're looking miles down that edge. I'm guessing you could put Bowling Green on that piece of ice. Probably more. Probably. I won't say Warren County, but a whole big, this is a really big piece of ice. I'm trying to shoot a panorama, but just shooting it from a moving boat, so it didn't work this time. Glacial ice is blue. Except sometimes you see some weird things. This is this one particular patch of brown. That's kind of interesting. And of course, I have no idea what it was. You'd have to actually go and penetrate that core and pull some of that out. But that's interesting. That must have been, I'm guessing, some kind of a big volcanic event. Drop some something on this ice. Glacial ice is blue, sometimes very dark blue. I know it's kind of, I'll play with that one a bit. That's one of my favorite pictures. As a matter of fact, I wrote a piece on, I should have mentioned this earlier, I wrote a textbook, co-author of a textbook in physical geography, and in this book I have a number of the pictures that I've taken from this particular trip. But I wrote a piece on glacial ice is blue. Glacial ice gets blue because as it gets heavier, the ice compacts, becomes more dense. As it becomes more dense, it takes on the blue color. When snow is very, very new, of course, it's white, and ice that's very, very new is very white. But as ice compacts and gets older and denser, it becomes very blue. But, again, it's ice is all over the place, and of course, these are glaciers, ice on the coastline. Every day, several times a day, we took sorties. You know, you get off the boat and go down the plank, get into a Zodiac, right? And these were the boats, the taxis, if you will, shuttles, if you will, that shuttled us back and forth from the ship to whatever island or mainland we may be. And we'll go there in a minute, but first, a scientific interlude. Right? Little science, throw a little science at you, it's good for you. There was a reason for my going, and one was I wanted to explore a little bit more about the ozone hole, being the climatologist that I am. I like this because this is a information bulletin, number 56, from the Argentine Air Force. It is the Air Force that runs the Weather Service, or what they call the National Meteorological Service. And this is actually quite common, not only in places like Argentina, but there are a lot of countries where the Air Force and the Weather Service are one and the same, or subunits of the same thing. And this one is entitled The Ozone Hole. And again, it's nice because it's the Argentine people talking about the ozone hole rather than some environmental group here in the United States. And this purple area, of course, is the depiction of the hole at this point. All right, here's Antarctica, there's the peninsula. Okay, here's South America, there's Ushuaia, which actually does fall into the area of the ozone hole, at least for a part of the year. And there's Drake's Passage. While out there, I did visit a number of research facilities. I mean, I did more than just go and try to shoot penguins. This is an Argentine research facility. You can tell it's Argentine because all of the Argentine stations are painted a reddish-orange color. And this is the Admiral Brown. I just realized, Hai Wong, it's my fault, not yours. This is backwards, but that's okay. This is the Admiral Brown Research Station. These are basically marine biologists. This is something called a safe house. Thank God there's a few of these. A safe house is it's kind of like international property. It doesn't necessarily belong to anybody. If you're stuck out there, you get lost, you go astray, you're stuck, you need shelter. You go up to one of these places, it's padlocked, but you'll find a rock, very easy to find a big rock. You break the padlock and you get in, and there's blankets and food and stuff that could help you if you really needed it. And so there's a few of these here and there. This is Port Lockroy, the British station. That is a snowflake. This was the only place where it snowed. And again, bearing in mind that it's summertime. Yeah, I'm there in February. It's summertime. This is a summer jacket. This is not a winter coat. This is a summer jacket. But it did snow. I wanted to see some snow. It felt appropriate. All the rest of the white is penguins. Tens of thousands of penguins. Everywhere you go, thousands of penguins. These guys, these two British gentlemen, are marine biologists. They monitor penguins. And here's the station at Palmer. Palmer is the U.S. station. Now, at that time, the U.S. had three major stations on Antarctica: the South Pole, McMurdo, which is in another part of the continent, and Palmer on the peninsula. And this is the Palmer station. Palmer, say, of course, American stations are blue, right? Each country has got their color, so you know whose they are. And of course, a lot of very well equipped. You'd be very proud that the taxpayers' dollars are. We had the best station. Here they monitor ultraviolet radiation. Again, the ozone hole. What's the problem with the ozone hole letting on too much ultraviolet radiation? The official reporting station for the Antarctic Peninsula is there at Palmer. And me and this guy, well, we just had a great conversation, talked for a few hours. It was fun to just meet all these scientists and interact. Meanwhile, back in Ushuaia, all right, the Global Atmospheric Watch is what this stands for. The station of Ushuaia is the official ozone reporting station. This is a Dobson spectrometer. Now, again, I've got some students in the audience. Dobson, you know that the ozone is measured in Dobson units. Dobson units are what is read on the Dobson spectrometer, invented by a guy by the name of Dobson. And I always wanted to see one of these up close and personal, and there it was. This is the way we monitor ozone looking up from the surface. We also have satellites that circle the Earth and monitor the ozone from aloft, but this is the way we monitor ozone from the surface. Okay, let's get back to the, just a little science. I thought I'd poke you with a little science so you won't forget what's going on here. All right, this is neat. This is a cinder cone. This is a volcano. I mean, obviously, there are some of these islands and features are volcanic. And here was a cinder cone. It was late in the day. I wanted to climb the thing, but it was late in the day. It was getting dark, and we needed to head back. But I kind of regret. That's one of my regrets, is not spending more time there. This I wanted to show something that's not very exciting, but very real. Frost-shattered rocks. In the Antarctic, a very strong process that works on Earth materials is what we call freeze and thaw, frost-shattering. Water, in a liquid form, seeps into the rocks and cracks and crevices between rocks. As you know, when water freezes, it expands. It expands in volume and breaks the rock apart. Basically breaking it apart, shattering it into pieces, into sharp, angular pieces. And this is essentially I won't say the only process, not by any means, but a major process all over the Antarctic Islands. Again, very much frost shattering and cracking of rocks. A little bit of lichen activity here. Lichens, of course, are very, very simple plant life, essentially, that feeds on rock. It's more like a stain. It looks more like a stain than an organism. And so I was thinking, oh, wow, you know, is this all the life I'm going to see at Antarctica? No. Here, again, a slightly different island. Again, more frost-shattered rocks and some moss. Oh, my God, moss. We got moss. All right. This is the thing that surprised me. Not because of little happy feet. Little heck, I love those happy feet. Yeah, well, first of all, because there's many more penguins than just three or four. But the thing that amazed me is sand. The mere fact that they made tracks meant that that's sand. I didn't expect that. That surprised me. Yeah, again, I'm sure it doesn't surprise you that much. That surprised me. I didn't expect sand. I expected shattered rocks, of course. Pebble beaches, maybe. Sand, I did not expect. I was so elated that I had to gouge my foot into the sand to take a picture to remind myself that I was really quite surprised about this. This is what most beaches, you know, which you would expect. Again, some frost-shattered rocks, but again, of some rounding of the rocks. You see, rounding of the rocks suggests a lot of working of water to round the rocks into rounder pebbles. To work those pebbles down to sand-sized particles, again, that means a lot of wave action, that some of these islands are exposed for greater periods of time, and that there's a lot of geologic processes going on. Right. This, here we've got, of course, lichens. Right. At one time thought that that was the only life on this particular island. However, you see this big white spot here? Right. Well, we had a lot of penguins here. They're not there now, but there was a whole bunch of them sitting there for a while ago. The reason I include this particular slide is not because of the frost shattering, but to remind me that this was probably the most dangerous situation I had. I climbed up this this hill because I wanted to take a look at it. There had been an instrument up in that little box up there, and I was just curious. When I was there trying to descend, I realized that this is all very, very sharp shards of rock. And I'm thinking, if you take a tumble, you will bleed. I mean, there's no two ways about it. You're going to get hurt on that. And so obviously descending very carefully. But again, I thought that you could conceivably, that was a dangerous situation. Oh, and then I found some more moss. I thought, oh my God, these forests are like a forest. I was excited. How can you get excited over moss? Well, you will if lichens is all you got. You're afraid of that. And this particular island, which I'll show you more pictures of, I started finding carpets of moss. Right? As I never, again, I didn't expect this. I mean, serious, you know, I just kind of kicked a little bit off, and I guess I kind of hurt the little plant a little bit, but I kicked a little bit off to get a better picture. Again, and that's a thick carpet. That's a thick carpet of moss. Right? Surprising thing about it is that this island was not only almost totally ice-free, but this whole area was covered in moss. This, by Antarctic standards, this is a garden paradise. This is a jungle. This is a rainforest. This is, you know, vegetation run amok here. That was just amazing. That was Echo Island. This is probably one of my most favorite pictures I've ever taken anywhere I've ever gone. I love this scene. Because this is the same island, that's all right here, all of this greenish stuff there, that's all moss. It's all the moss. But again, this island has been worked by all kinds of wind action, frost action, all kinds of things. Look at this, and to me, that's kind of fun because that reminds me a little bit of Monument Valley, you know, in Arizona. Yeah? John Wayne and his troops, you know, the mittens out there. God, I love this picture. I really do. That's in the book. There's again a picture of the again we're getting off that island and penguins in the foreground. We got the explorer and penguins everywhere. We estimate when all was said and done somewhere between 250,000 maybe 300,000 penguins were in our presence somewhere along the line. Every island, tens of thousands. Your trouble is sometimes it's not stepping on them. You have to know about krill. Krill is a very simple life form. Okay, you can see it looks like a little shrimp. Krill is about the size of a house key. Not the size you hold in your finger, the size you stick in the lock. Okay? That's about the average size of krill. Krill, the title got washed out a bit, is the power food of the Antarctic. Everything eats krill. Krill eats plankton. Everything eats krill. Right? Including penguins. Right? Here's some Gentoo penguins. And of course, in some ways, it's good that there is too much light in here. There's a lot of red on those rocks. Because of the krill, feces in the Antarctic is red. And, penguins, by the tens of thousands, cute as they are birds. Tens of thousands of them roosting together. You smell them before you see them. Now again, I don't want to destroy anybody's romantic, estimate of little happy feet dancing. National Geographic isn't going to tell you this, bunch of wimps. I'll tell you the truth. You smell them before you see them. This particular type of penguins are called chinstrap penguins. These are the smallest of the varieties. Chinstraps are maybe a foot high. About a foot high. They do mate for life. There's a little romantic interlude. Right? And you can see, I think, why they call them chinstraps. And they mate for life. Not all penguins, but most do. And they take turns in child-rearing. They usually have one chick, maybe two. Maybe two. Here we got mother and child here. I don't know if you can see it very well. There's a little baby penguin. These are Gentoo penguins. These are bigger. These are not quite 2 feet, maybe a foot and a half to 2 feet tall. They have a very distinctive orange bill and white temples, if you will. And, of course, here's the little baby. Now, this is an island that has no vegetation whatsoever. What does a penguin use to build a nest? Well, pebbles. Little tiny pebbles. It's kind of interesting. Little rings of pebbles. Yeah. And again, keeping them. Penguins, like many birds, feed their young by gorging themselves, going back, regurgitating to the youth. In this particular one, actually, that one's getting kind of big, and that's more of an adolescent, but there's mom still doing her job. At one point in time, we were told, in a briefing before we left, look, don't get within 15 feet of the penguins, because you'll stress them. You don't want to stress the penguins. Stay 15 feet. You can show up at 5 meters. Okay, all right, that's fine. I don't want to break the law. And God knows I don't want to stress these penguins. But you get off to an island, and there isn't 15 feet between you. I mean, they're all over the place. So again, your problem is not, staying far enough away. Your problem is not stepping on one. At one point, I was on the beach and looking at stuff and taking pictures, and all of a sudden, on my boot, I feel this. And I look down, and there's this adolescent young penguin, cheep, 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 banging on my boots. And it's saying, it's saying, feed me. Come on, buddy, cough up. And I'm trying to think of, what did I have for breakfast? I mean, can you handle a bagel? I mean, what can you do? I don't know. They are as lovable as you think they would be. Here, these are some Adelies, and again, the contrast is a little tough. Adelie penguins they're totally black head and a black a beak. If I'm not mistaken, I saw an ad for the cartoon movie, I guess it's Happy Feet, and I think some of these guys star in that. They're doing something called a penguin run. This is interesting because I shot this one, saw many of them, and was trying to figure out what they were doing. And I thought it was a game. Follow the leader. See, lead penguin is running everywhere, up and down and around, and doing this obstacle course. And there's four or five chicks running after it, just like a little train, and they're going crazy. Eventually, one of the chicks will drop off. And they keep running, and then the next one will drop off. And they keep running, and then the next one will drop off. Eventually, only one, maybe two, will still be on the trail. And that's mom, and those are hers. The others were just penguins wanting a free ride, wanting a free meal. And she has to, again, it's, I think I'm feeding back here, excuse me. I mean, she's only got a certain amount of food. She's got to feed her, or she can't be feeding the neighborhood, you know? This is, again, nature's way is kind of fun. This, again, here's a chin strap and kind of paying homage, I guess, to a fallen comrade. This is interesting, and still I'm not sure because I saw a lot of carcasses, dead penguins, that seemed like they had been turned inside out. Fur seals love penguins. I'm not sure exactly. This is the way it was explained to me. Maybe you can understand it. I think I do. They bite the penguin by the head, somehow cut into the skin, blow in, I guess, separating the skin from the flesh, and then whip it. And all of a sudden, this penguin is peeled. I mean, I've seen penguins, their skin was like rolled up. And this is an exposed spine. So now the penguin is peeled, and you peel the penguin. Yeah, I mean, I found about a half dozen of these before I said, what is this? And somebody explained to me what was going on. All right, this, again, even if the lights were off, this is still kind of a rough contrast. This is a skua, which is kind of a predatory bird. It's a little bit bigger than a seagull, but not quite a hawk. And it kept attacking me. And at this particular island, and I realized that I was close to a nest, obviously. So, as I backed away, there she was, defiantly saying, well, I guess I told you. All right, let's get into some pinnipeds, all right? The seals, lots of seals. This is a young adult. No, I'm sorry. Yes, it's a young adult male elephant seal. This little snout here, because it's young, eventually will become very big and will eventually kind of hang down and slop around, not quite like an elephant's trunk, although that's where it gets its name, but, again, has this kind of long snout. These are huge. I mean, it's 20, 25 feet long and incredibly big and fat. And when they fight, when you get two males fighting, all they can do is just get up and slam up against each other. Because they don't bite. They can't bite. How are you going to bite through that lip? They don't scratch. They don't punch. They just body slam each other. It's really kind of interesting in its way. This is a Weddell seal, the poster child of Save the Seal. Here's another shot that you can tell it's the one with the puppy dog eyes and the cute little face. And there's the poster child of Save the Seal. So we've got a couple of chin straps and actually a fur seal. There was one particular island where there were thousands of fur seals and they were all laid out and they were dead to the world. And what they'd done is just completed a large migratory swim. And they got to this island and they just collapsed. So that's all they could do was get there. They had to rest up because in about a week, the girls were coming. Again, Antarctica, you go to feed, breed, raise your young, and get out of there before the next winter. That's the whole name of the game. This is a leopard seal. I don't know if you can see it very well, but there's leopard spots all over. These get vicious. One of these tried to bite the Zodiac. Wait, he's trying to bite the boat. What's his problem? Here's a fur seal, and not a very good shot of it, but he had an accident. He had an accident here on this ice. Feces is red in the Antarctic. You're not going to see it. National Geographic isn't going to show you this. Yeah? Discovery Channel, they're a bunch of wimps. Travel Channel, forget about it. I'll show you reality. All right. Here's, again, let's have fun. This is a crab eater. Again, very distinctive style of head, very long and slender. It's called the crab eater seal. And here's a fur seal. fur seals get nasty during mating season. When we were walking around all those thousands that were lying there resting up, we kept making noise. You have to take a stick and a rock and bang them together, make noise, because you don't want to shock them, you don't want to surprise them. If they know you're coming, that's good. If you surprise them, that's not good. They could attack. And a blonde fur seal. Actually, I saw one of these in a museum. It was stuffed in a museum because this is pretty rare. It's like the albino of the fur seals. And sure enough, there was one just sitting there looking at me. Well, let's leave the world of seals behind and go towards whales. Whales are cool. Everybody likes to see whales. Humpbacks, these were. Humpback whales are big. And at one point, several of them just came up to the ship. And I've never seen it. You know, we usually go on a whale hunt or something. You see them in the distance. You hope to get them up close. Here, I mean, they're swimming right up to the ship. Again, the contrast is kind of tough. But there's the humpback. There's his face. There's fins. He goes right off the screen. There he is. And they just kind of tilt and just looking at you. I'm just looking at him. Ah, it's just wild. And one of the marine biologists went crazy. He said, God, this is some kind of a spiritual thing. So, well, you know, yeah, and some people hug trees and talk to crystals and, you know, that kind of stuff. But it was remarkable. It truly was remarkable. And again, the entire land, I mean, these things get to, well, these are about 80, I'd say at least a good 80 feet long. I mean, God, they were big. There she glows. That, incidentally, is, you see that right there? That's a rainbow. Sometimes you get a spray of water right at the sun angle, right? You get a little rainbow. There she blows. It's always interesting. You see it on TV. What you don't realize is that, you know, with a humpback, it's got two blowholes. One is for respiration, and the other one is digestive. When it blows, everybody goes, ooh, and then you get downwind and everybody goes, oh. Yeah, I was like, whoa, you know, you wish you had a 50-pound Tic Tac or something. Have some of this, my God. You know, what, National Geographic, you think they're going to tell you about this? Right? Bunch of wimps. Right? Reality. Again, no, up close and, you know, seriously, I mean, from the standpoint, of course, whaling, nobody hate the thought of it, but really, all you have to do is drop a harpoon. I mean, literally, it was just right there. Whales leave what is called a footprint. Now, remember, a whale is a greasy animal, right? Because for many years, they hunted whales to cut up the blubber, melt it down into whale oil. Right? Whales are greasy, so when they go in, they leave a little grease spot behind. And the grease, again, kind of kills the ripples inside, so you can always tell where a whale has just submerged. Where it pops out, I don't know. Here in humpbacks, which is what the whales you were seeing, do this amazing thing. It's called bubble netting. And I've never seen a diagram of it, and I've never seen a photo of it, but this is the way it works. Remember the krill? Remember that big school of krill, the little shrimpy-looking things, okay? Again, two or three humpbacks will start and just yell at them and bark at them and everything, because humpbacks, they sing up a storm. They're very vocal. They kind of scare them kind of in a pile. And then one or two of them go down below. Okay, say the school is up here. And one or two of them go below the school and start swimming around, blowing little tiny greasy bubbles. The greasy bubbles, because they're greasy, can maintain their integrity as they rise. So what they do is they set up like a cylinder. It's called bubble netting, like a net, a cylinder of bubbles, and it's just kind of literally herding these krill in towards the middle. Then they go down to the bottom, open their mouth, and come right up the middle, and just, you know, with all that food right in their mouth. And of course they burst through, okay, they breach. And baleen whales, which is what these are, they can't fall on their stomach. If they do, they might collapse their ribs. They have to, once they breach, take a quarter turn or a half turn and then hit the water on their back or side, you know, where the rib cage could handle the weight of a whale slapping up against water. You know, when you were a kid, did they ever do a belly flop in the swimming pool? You know how that hurts like heck? Yeah, right. Oh, clouds of red. coming out of the back of a whale? Oh my God, would he actually show us something like that? Well, yeah, because, you know, Discovery Channel ain't going to show you, right? Travel Channel's not going to show you. They're a bunch of wimps, lightweights. I will show you the truth, right? Another shot at the Explorer. We went farther south. We started to break ice a little bit. This is pack ice or sea ice. Okay, these are not icebergs. These are not glaciers. This is frozen seawater. And it's about a meter or two thick, and you know, so you can break through some of that. They're trying to head down towards the Antarctic Circle. You know, and some of this shows you some close-up of sea ice. All right. At this point, we were pretty much done. I went up to the bridge, talked to the captain, we pulled off the latest facts. There was a storm that had just passed. Monster. There was a storm that was ready to come in to the Drake's Passage. And in between, and again for my students who already, there was a ridge, an area of high pressure in between those two storms. I looked at the captain and I said, now, let's go now. And we took a 55-hour trip and turned it into a 48-hour trip. And tried to make it through. As we're starting to pull home, a number of porpoises came out to say, kind of, welcome back, gang. And then at the distance, I saw a dot. And as the dot got bigger, I realized this was the tip. This is Cape Horn. This is the very, very tip of South America as you're coming in from the Antarctic. And you notice that the skies are rather gray, but that's okay because in a short period of time we'll be out of open sea and into protected waters, and we're okay, and we're pretty much safe at home. So as the sun sets into the west, in this case way, way, way southwest, let's say goodbye to our fumbling wanderer, and I appreciate your attention, and thank you very much for your kind attention.
We have time for some questions. Yes, back here. Protected water.
What is protected water? Okay, open sea, you know, then anything can happen. Protected water is when you're either on the other side of an island, the leeward side of an island, or you're in a channel somewhere, and that way, no matter how the winds are blowing, the waves won't get too crazy because you've got all kinds of windbreaks around you. So yeah, being in protected water, which was most, once we got to the Antarctic, you know, sailing in between islands, we were always in protected water. It was that voyage getting there where you cross the open sea. That's where things got weird and scary.
Someone mentioned one time on one of these trips that there are actually geothermal springs in Antarctica. If you could, did you encounter any?
Well, no, I did not encounter any, but it has been, as a matter of fact, there's been some that have been discovered beneath layers of ice, and at this point in time, I don't know how any access, mainly I would think it would be mainly sonar that has picked up on it, but they have picked up on some activity, but it's under the ice. And to tell you the truth, I don't know if any of it actually emerges.
Emerges, so yeah. No swimming.
No, no little hot pools or anything.
Over here?
Yeah.
Oh,
so what temperatures were you having in there summer or February?
It wasn't bad. I would say, in the 30s maybe, something like that. Wind chill will cut you in half. But if the winds die down, the sun pops up, and you're out hiking around. Oh yeah, at one point in time I had to take my jacket off. Well, that last picture, I had my jacket unzipped because I was sweating. I climbed up, that picture was taken, I don't recall who took it off me, but we had climbed this thing, and I was sweating.
Corbin?
Are there any land animals on Antarctica?
No, nothing that I encountered, no. Again, everything just comes in. You know, it's got a couple of months. That's where to go, and then they have to get out.
Where do they go?
Well, there's for instance, penguins and other places where you could see lots and lots and lots of penguins would be again in South America, but on the coast, basically higher latitude, so down in the Horn. I saw all kinds of seals and penguins even before going to the Antarctic as I was traveling through Argentina. And of course, you know, parts of New Zealand, certain islands.
Giving Wet Night, Icebound, a doctor, that incredible story of the physician who I think contracted cancer and managed to survive. Yeah. Thanks very much. We hope you'll join us next month. Coming in on the 8th, we have the state forensic anthropologist, Dr. Meg Craig. She'll be talking both on campus at 2 p.m. and mass media, and here again at 7 p.m. And then Dr. Jim Flynn will be talking, and his class, who visited Ireland last year, will be here, not as it says on the calendar, because the spring break has changed, but the week following spring break on the 22nd of March. So we hope you'll join us next month, and again, thanks very much.